As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Oh, hi. Hello. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, who is deeply apologetic for ever thinking it was a good idea to turn this play into a series of narrative episodes. Turns out comedy really just needs to be appreciated by reading the play itself, or better yet, watching a production. Turning it into a narrative? Nearly impossible, but here I am doing my best because I started something and I'm going to finish it. This is the last episode in my series on this play, and aren't we all glad for it? It does redeem itself a bit, I will admit, and fortunately, my conversation episode coming on Friday makes the play actually interesting and truly helps to redeem this entire series. I cannot wait for you to hear it. I cannot express how much it helps in the understanding and appreciating of this play. But I did write this episode before speaking with my upcoming guest, George Kovacs, and he really opened my eyes to a lot of things that make this play interesting and worth reading. So apologies if those things aren't entirely clear in this episode, but we are going to talk about them on Friday, and you will be convinced. And until then, where we last left off on this absolute hot mess of a play, Euripides had convinced his father-in-law, Menesilicus, to infiltrate the women's only festival, the Thesmophoria. He'd shaved his beard and put on a dress and whatever other clothes they got their hands on, and apparently convinced all of these women that he was indeed a woman. The women made their cases against Euripides, lots of claims about the types of women he writes, lots of complaints by women that were absolutely written by a man, because their main concern was both giving away their secrets and writing too often about women like Phaedra, flawed and complex women, when they apparently wish he would write about virtuous, quote-unquote good women, like Penelope. It's like those wild phrases men write about women, you know, that make it sound like absolutely nothing about them is realistic in the slightest and they're just some bizarre and creepy ideal of a male fantasy. Yeah, that's kind of what this is like. It's bananas. Fortunately, Menesilicus' defense of Euripides, which is really just another series of stereotypical and nonsense insults of women, is interrupted by Cleisthenes, another character who's meant to be extremely effeminate and who, we're to understand, is the submissive in his relationships with other men and thus the less respected party in gay Athenian relationships. There's a lot to unpack here. We will be talking about it in this week's conversation episode. So a reminder that this play is messy as hell, and frankly, I wish I'd never started it, but I'm not about to leave you all hanging with this madness. So today's episode is going to just finish it off for good. But let's just remember about some of the more problematic issues of this play. One is the crux of the story hinges on a man dressing as a woman to infiltrate a women's festival. Frankly, this sounds like this combination of like, ha ha ha, men dressed as women, that is funny, and some nonsense shit that TERFs would spew in an effort to hate trans women. So I just want to address it all quite clearly that he is a man dressing as a woman. That is the point of the story. There is no gender questioning when it comes to Menesilicus. There are characters in this play that I think maybe could be read as trans or just vaguely gender nonconforming. They would be Cleisthenes and Agathon, not Menesilicus. He is a character, a joke. He is a comic relief. How funny, a man dressed as a woman. Can you hear my eyes rolling into the back of my head? Obviously, that kind of humor isn't particularly entertaining anymore. Thank the gods. But this is an ancient Athenian play that I shouldn't have covered, but here we are. All I knew is that it included Euripides' slander that I wanted to talk about, and a women's only festival. How cool it sounded. Of course, it all comes at the cost of every woman's character and an absurd amount of dick jokes and generally just gross everything. With all of that said, I spoke with last week's conversation guest, Julie Levy, after writing the second episode, but before writing this one, and I'm very thankful for that. She did kind of like pull me back from the brink when it comes to this play and my resolve to loathe it. Not that I've changed my tune all that much in the broader sense, but I've got a better appreciation of Aristophanes himself, the history of the time, and frankly, it's just reassuring to talk up Euripides so much. So I highly recommend you listen to that episode because it's incredibly insightful and really helps in understanding this play. And then Friday's upcoming conversation is only going to make it better. And still, fortunately for all of us, the last bits of this play that we're yet to cover are some of the least obnoxious. They're really lacking in the crude, gross jokes, and are fortunately the most interesting when it comes to my beloved Euripides. So this episode should actually be a fun way to cap off this wild and ridiculous play. This is episode 202. Men writing absurd female characters, but make it ancient. Cleisthenes has arrived at the Thesmophoria. He is, it appears, the only man that is allowed to attend this women's only festival. We are told that he's a man who loves women, so they don't seem to take any issue with his appearance there. It probably helps that the first thing he says to the women at the festival is, quote, "Darlings, darlings, you know how much I love you. I do everything you do. Behave just like a girl. See? Look how smooth my cheeks are. Not the slightest shadow of a beard. I am your sister." Now, this is Aristophanes insulting Cleisthenes, but I think we can all agree that it makes him far more interesting and appealing than Aristophanes' other characters. Like Agathon, I just enjoy this character and could probably be his friend. It's also an interesting and more than valid reading to consider whether Cleisthenes either might have been trans or gender fluid in real life, or that Aristophanes is writing him as such. Either way, attempted insult or otherwise, it's a great example of a gender fluid people existing in the ancient world. If Aristophanes is writing characters like this, it means at the very least he'd encountered people like this version of Cleisthenes, even if Cleisthenes himself might not have been this way in real life. Regardless, Cleisthenes is here with news. He's at the festival. He's not just there to hang out with the women, as much as it seems like that's all he wants to do. No, he is there to tell them of a horrible rumor that he has heard. A man has infiltrated the Thesmophoria, and no, it's not him. He tells the women gathered that he's heard that an in-law of Euripides has disguised himself as a woman and has snuck in to the Thesmophoria as a spy for the tragedian. The women ask Cleisthenes for more details. How does he know this, and how could Euripides possibly have sent this man in as a spy without them realizing? Cleisthenes explains that he's disguised, that he's hairless and appearing as a woman. Aristophanes has a real thing for suggesting that the removal of Menesilochus' pubic hair is somehow the necessary piece of the puzzle that disguises him as a woman. And I mean, I see flaws in this plan, but whatever, I am not here to focus on that, that's Aristophanes' weird obsession. But as much as the women can't believe that they would have let this happen, Cleisthenes is certain. He wouldn't have come here if he weren't sure that this had happened and he needed to warn them. He reassures them that this is the case, and so they recruit Cleisthenes to help them root out this man disguised amongst them. And Menesilochus gets worried. Cleisthenes goes to Mica first, that woman who's been most vocal in her fight with Menesilochus. He questions her, but she has got history, she's got backup. She doesn't need to convince anyone who she is. She name drops her husband, Cleonymus, though the reference point she uses to suggest everyone should know who he is that he dropped his shield on the battlefield and ran for his life. Just another jab for Aristophanes to get in, suggesting that not only are all women cheaters, but they don't respect the men in their lives. He is fun, this so-called comedian. But everyone knows who Mica is, so Cleisthenes moves on, spotting Menesilochus as he tries to escape unnoticed. Quote, "And you, hey you, stop right there. Where do you think you're going?" Menesilochus buys himself just a little bit of time by saying that he's got to pee, and he rushes off behind something to hide for a moment. But Cleisthenes has him pulled out once he's taken too long and presses Menesilochus for information. "Who's your husband?" he asks. "What's his name?" Because, you know, that's what matters. Menesilochus is not a good liar, at least not right now. He made up some absurd stories about nonsense things earlier, but not now. So he makes up the name of a town his supposed husband is from and then says, quote, "You know that guy. You know, the guy who once... Oh, dear. You know the guy who's the son of that guy who..." Yeah, like I said, he's a bad liar. Cleisthenes calls him on it and then moves on to asking whether Menesilochus has been to the festival before. If he has, that's better proof that he is not the one disguised as a man. "Of course I've been here before," Menesilochus says, and tries to guess things that happened at last year's festival in an attempt to prove his lie to be true. Critilla, one of the women, moves on to interrogate Menesilochus. She knows what happened at the festival last year. She can tell if he's lying. She asks a few questions about what happened, moments that Menesilochus should recall if he was indeed at last year's Thesmophoria. He convinces her, for a moment at least, by guessing pretty obvious things that would take place at a festival like this. But it doesn't take long before he makes some stupid joke about women peeing in bowls, because Aristophanes absolutely loves vaguely misogynistic potty humor. Fortunately, this is when he is found out. Something is not right. Critilla notes. It's definitely him. Let's find him out. And this is when an absolutely absurd moment occurs in which the comically large phallus that Menesilicus has been wearing, because again, Aristophanes believes that dick jokes are the absolute height of comedy, this is when that phallus really gets its time to shine. There's a whole weird comic scene where it basically flaps backward and forwards so that the people on either side of Menesilicus can and then can't see it as proof. And anyway, it's all just weird and feels icky to me, so we're not focusing on it. I'm sure it would have been funny in the ancient world. We'll give him that. The point is that Menesilicus has been found out. The women at the Thesmophoria now know that he is the one who's been a man disguised as a woman this entire time. But now they're worried he might not be alone. The chorus begins to sing of searching for any other man who might have attempted to infiltrate their space. They'll search and search, and Zeus help the man if they find another in their midst. But while this is happening, Menesilicus does something in an attempt to get the heat off of him for a moment. Mica, you see, the woman who's been his greatest foil during the whole of this festival, has had a child with her all along. Or rather, a wet nurse with her who's been holding her baby throughout the festival. And when the chorus begins to search, the wet nurse goes to nurse the child. It's at this moment that Menesilicus snatches the baby away from Mica's wet nurse, pulls a knife from where it's been hidden amongst his clothes, and waves it around as he threatens the life of this baby. Quote, "Scream all you want, girlies. If you won't let me go right now, this baby will never see another tit again. I'm going to cut open all the veins of her little thigh, splatter the altar with her bright red blood, right here, right now, a million cuts with this knife." Now, this is a specific reference to Euripides and his work. There's a lost play called Telephos, where this man, Telephos, snatches the baby Orestes and threatens him in order to save himself. Aristophanes is giving us a tragedy, this crazed man threatening a baby's life, and violently at that. Mica begins to scream in panic. She calls to the women around her, calling for help and explaining that he's taken her baby, her only child. They have to stop him. The chorus joins her. They're all angry and concerned and begin to yell threats at Menesilicus. Eventually, Mica and her wet nurse leave. They're going to get supplies so that it seems they can burn Menesilicus alive. Don't really blame them, it's fine. After all, he's snatched a tiny helpless baby and is threatening the poor thing's life. Except that this is Aristophanes. Once Mica and her wet nurse have left the stage, at least for the time being, Menesilicus takes a closer look at the baby that he's snatched and has been threatening. He talks to it, continuing to threaten its life, and then unwraps some of the baby's coverings. Only to find it's wine. It's a wineskin that's been disguised to look like a baby. Because, yeah, this is Aristophanes, and women love getting drunk, you know? That's what he's saying. They're all sex-obsessed alcoholics who can't be trusted with anything. I mean, honestly, though, this is funny. I like wine disguised as a baby. That's something I would do. Once he's discovered this bizarre plot twist, Mica and her wet nurse return with the supplies. They begin to stack wood around Menesilicus, preparing, again, to burn him alive. Normal stuff. But, of course, now that he's got something on them, he's going to have a little bit of fun with it. "This is your baby, hey?" he asks Mica. "Obviously," she replies. "I carried it for 9 months." "Did you really? The full 9 months?" he presses. She swears by Artemis that she did. Which is when Menesilicus lets the swaddling clothes fall away, revealing the wineskin. And he says, quote, "Ripper of a baby, Mica. What's it hold? 3 jugs? Again, that's funny. Mica doesn't let go of her ruse, though, calling him out for removing her tiny baby's clothes so brazenly. To which he replies, quote, "Tiny? By Zeus, how old is it? 3, 4 wine festivals old?" And now she's in on it. She just wants her fucking wine. Mica replies, quote, Yeah, around that. Born around the last Dionysiac festival. Give it to me. Mika now continues to be Aristophanes' gross and weird women's stereotype. She continues fighting with Menesilicus as if he truly holds her baby captive, as if she wants that wine more than she'd want her baby. It would be funnier if I didn't know how much this entire play is just Aristophanes inventing weird stereotypes that make women look bad. Because other than that, I mean, I am with her. I prefer wine to babies and children, no question. When Menesilicus continues threatening the fake baby with the knife, Mika goes so far as to have her nurse, whose name is Mania, by the way, because Aristophanes is nothing if not obvious, she has Mania grab the sacrificial bowl meant for the festival, so that if Menesilicus goes through with his threat to stab the wineskin baby, the bowl will catch the wine, and thus none of it will be wasted. Again, I do really like this moment, because wine. Eventually, Menesilicus does stab the wineskin baby, and wine leaks into the sacrificial bowl just like blood. And with that, he decides he can give the baby up. But the wine is now the property of the priestess, so he hands Cratilla the baby instead. And she also continues to treat the wineskin as if it's actually Mika's baby that's been ripped from her breast in some kind of horribly traumatic event. It's funny, but gods, Aristophanes hates women, hey? But fortunately for us, this is when the play takes a turn into utilizing more obvious references to Euripides' plays. Far more enjoyable in my books, given Euripides is actually a good writer of interesting characters, even when those characters are being satirized by Aristophanes. Menesilicus looks around, trying to determine what his next move is, how he can save himself. I've got it, he says to himself. I will reenact a scene from Euripides' play, The Palamedes, where Palamedes writes a note on an oar and throws it into the sea for it to find someone to help him. Just like the Telephos, this play doesn't survive, but we can get an idea of it based on this scene. He scratches some things into little tablets of wood that he finds, and he passes them around to the chorus, as if they're being sent out on the waves of the sea. And then the chorus of women sings what they describe as a praising words for their gender, but is more wild stereotypes and bizarre nonsense. They basically just sing about what they say men say about them, how they're horrible, the cause of misery and war, quote, the very womb of conflict and clash. They sing of how all men, all of their husbands, see them as what this translation calls bum pains. They sing of how they're superior to men and that they're going to provide the so-called proof of this.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
The chorus is singing about how much better women are than men. But, well, they're doing it in a very Aristophanic way. Because as Julie pointed out so appropriately in our conversation episode last week, this is where Aristophanes gets his politics in. Every moment that the women use as an example of how women are better than men is a jab at certain types of men and political figures, namely anti-war characters and men who ran from or failed at war. That and men who steal from the polis, things like that. Basically, he's just getting in all of his conservative, hawkish viewpoints through these voices of women. I suppose it's kind of nice it's not outwardly insulting of women for once, even if it's not really singing their praise either. There is, however, a lot of blame placed on women for having sons who grow up to be what Aristophanes considers shitty or bad. Accusations that such women shouldn't be allowed in the festival, things like that. So, you know, it still manages to be insulting to women, even when he's more explicitly not being insulting to women. Fortunately for us, and more importantly, me, as I try and fail to make this episode fun and entertaining, we're moving past that to a little more action aimed specifically at Euripides. This is where Aristophanes is going to get even more jabs and insults in at the tragedian, but I can tell you right now that it's going to fail, because, well, you'll see. The first play he's going to seriously parody through the voice of Menesilicus is The Helen. Menesilicus begins to just channel Helen, but he's channeling that Helen from the Euripides play, which had been performed the year before this. Menesilicus speaks as Helen, pretending as though he's in a real tragedy himself, a dramatic performance of her play. It's meant to be over the top, I'm sure, but for the most part, it's just kind of a simplified version of Helen's speeches in Euripides' play. As he speaks, Critilla listens and seems to think that he's just saying these lines randomly. She doesn't necessarily understand that he's seemingly quoting Euripides, and so she provides the comedy aspect. Quote, "Another woman act. We haven't yet punished you for your first impersonation, and here you are at it again." Menesilicus just continues on as if she hasn't spoken to him at all, continuing to perform the parts of Helen, where she laments her missing husband, Menelaus. Remember, Euripides' version of Helen takes on this idea that she never went to Troy in the first place, that she was brought to Egypt and left there. Listen to my series on it. It is actually such an incredible play. It has become one of my favorites. Aristophanes, meanwhile, is certainly satirizing it, but we will get to exactly what that means. For now, Menesilicus, speaking as Helen, announces, quote, "Oh, how I wish my poor husband Menelaus were here, alive also." And there's noise off stage, and then Euripides returns to the stage, possibly even dressed as Menelaus in that play, covered in fishing nets as though he's just washed ashore from a shipwreck. And so the two of them just begin acting out moments from Euripides' Helen, with Euripides now playing this part of Menelaus. When I first read this, I couldn't quite get what Aristophanes was doing. The lines they're reciting are pretty benign, just moments from the play, simplified. The comedy aspect is Critilla jumping in, but Otherwise, it's pretty simple. At some point, Euripides, as Menelaus, asks who the angry woman is who is berating Mnesilica, says Helen. That would be Cratilla. Though Mnesilicus refers to her as Theonoe, one of the characters of that play. Throughout this, Cratilla is making these comments, just more complaints about Mnesilicus, but the Helen itself remains pretty tame and normal until it briefly devolves into a bit of a farce when they transition to a more romantic moment of the play. The revealing that Helen and Menelaus have found each other. That bit is clearly Aristophanes, once again, relying on the idea that it's just inherently funny to have a man dressed as a woman and performing this type of scene. It's tired and not at all funny, but it's there. Throughout reading this, I wondered, otherwise, what Aristophanes was getting at, given the rest of the play is all just a bizarre attack on Euripides and women, generally. But fortunately, when I spoke with Julie Levy for last week's conversation episode, she provided what seems like now to be obvious commentary. It's the play itself. It doesn't matter that Aristophanes isn't explicitly satirizing Euripides' lines. It's just the selection of Helen at all is kind of the insult. Because the Helen is about a version of Helen of Sparta who isn't villainized, who didn't start the Trojan War, who didn't cheat on her husband. She's this good person, a strong character, and the play is, most importantly, all about her. Menelaus in that play is a bit of a bumbling weirdo. She holds the plot together, and he's just kind of there. This is, of course, why I fucking love the Helen, but it's also why Aristophanes probably picked it to make fun of Euripides. As if the very existence of this version of her story is funny, just for the sake of it. This is Helen, after all, the most famously hated woman in Greek mythological history, and Euripides went and made her virtuous. Eventually, the two are interrupted when a magistrate arrives with a Scythian archer as his enforcement. And because this character is meant to be Scythian, not Greek, but speaking Greek, he has this very odd kind of accent that gets translated in different ways, but ultimately is meant to make clear that this is not a native Greek speaker. He's probably enslaved and just there to do the dirty work of enforcing the law with his archery skills. This also serves to remind Euripides that he's been avoiding this place in an attempt to, well, not be killed. So, of course, the arrival of these two spooks Euripides, and he sneaks off stage, leaving Mnesilicus alone once again. With the magistrate having arrived at the request of the women, he heads straight to Mnesilicus. Cratilla, of course, points him out immediately as the one who's infiltrated their festival and needs to be punished. The punishment, it seems, is, well, I'll say it's a bit over the top. He is, it appears, to be executed. An overreaction, I would say, but here we are. It will add to the comedy of it all. But first he begins to plead with the magistrate that he be stripped naked before he's killed, because he decides it would be far less embarrassing to die naked than to die dressed as a woman. Even goes so far as to say that the vultures tearing at his flesh would die laughing. Ha ha ha, Aristophanes, we get it. You think it's funny that a man is dressed like a woman. Hilarious. Fortunately, there's still more Euripides involved, and thus we get to enjoy this play a little bit more. Aristophanes might be obnoxious, but Euripides is still great, even when he's being parodied. See, the magistrate directs the Scythian archer to grab hold of Mnesilicus and secure him to some kind of plank. The point, ultimately, is that he's going to be tied up and left there, where he will take on the role of Andromeda, as she's tied up, awaiting her death by sea monster. Yet again, performing one of Euripides' most recent plays, The Andromeda, which had also premiered the year prior alongside Helen. The Andromeda references are particularly interesting to us today because the play itself, the one by Euripides, doesn't survive in anything but fragments. Unlike the Helen, we can't know exactly what he's playing with in the lines that Mnesilicus will recite as he performs as Andromeda, and instead they can just give us some insights into what the play might have actually looked like when Euripides had it performed. Given the representation of the Helen is fairly accurate, beyond being a bit overblown, we can imagine that the Andromeda would also be accurate. So thank you, Aristophanes, for this singular thing that you've given us. At least there is this. As Menesilicus is chained up by the Scythian, he starts to speak to himself about how he's going to get out of this one, when he suddenly announces, quote, "Aha! Looks like the boy hasn't abandoned me yet. I just saw him flying across the sky like Perseus wearing Hermes' winged sandals and winged cap. I suppose that means I ought to change roles now." So yeah, Menesilicus seemingly sees Euripides flying around as Perseus. I can't tell you how thrilled I am that the end of the play gets fun and silly and just references Euripides' plays rather than continuing on the theme of insulting women excessively. Phew. I will take weird moments of maybe Euripides flying around on a crane. Let's do it. Menesilicus easily steps into this new role of Andromeda. He's dressed as a woman and he's chained up. He's ready to go. He begins to speak as her, and he calls out to none other than Echo. He briefly calls to Echo before launching into this paratragic speech. It sounds like tragedy in a way. It isn't outright parodying it. Just like the Helen, it seems as though he's quoting at least some of the real lines from the play, calling out as Andromeda about her fate, how she's alone and missing all of the other girls of her age. Gods, I have trouble deciding on pronouns in these sections, but given that he is explicitly playing Andromeda, I feel comfortable changing them. Menesilicus, as Andromeda, keeps calling out, breaking character a bit to call out directly to Euripides, or as he says, the man who shaved him. It's a whole thing. I'm not going to repeat too much of it, because what matters is that eventually Euripides does return to the stage as Echo. This bit is kind of interesting because one of my translations makes it very clear that this is meant to be Euripides playing Echo, but one of mine doesn't, and it might just be an oversight, but it's quite interesting. Regardless, I love the idea that it is Euripides coming in as playing this Echo character who seems to have featured quite heavily into the Andromeda. Basically, this character of Echo really just serves to repeat the last things the prior person spoke. It doesn't really add much beyond, I guess, somewhat repetitive comedy. But regardless of that, it serves to give us this idea of what might have existed in the Andromeda for whatever reason. Regardless, this devolves into another comedic scene where the Scythian archer attempts to figure out who has arrived to help Menesilicus. And every time he seeks information, his words are just returned back to him via this Echo. And eventually he grabs for Echo and she escapes him, running off the stage as she repeats the words back to him, quote, "Grab the woman, bitch." Moving on, once more Euripides returns to the stage, but this time he's dressed as Perseus himself, there to rescue Andromeda from the sea monster, clad in Hermes' winged sandals. He announces, quote, "O gods, O speedy sandals, to which barbaric land have you brought me? I have flown through all the highways and byways of all the skies with my winged feet, heading for Argos. I am Perseus, and in this bag I am carrying the head of a Gorgon." Once more, we have this recreation of a scene from Euripides' play and from the myth of Perseus and Andromeda itself, juxtaposed with this bizarre scene of Menesilicus chained up at a woman's only festival, awaiting his fate. An echo has just echoed repeatedly, only to have Euripides as Echo run off stage and return immediately as Perseus, flying over the stage in the crane. It's fascinating. Just like the scene where they recreated the Helen, the pair recreate Andromeda, while the Scythian archer serves to inject this bizarre Athenian modernity along with his heavily accented speech. It's meant to add comedic elements to continue to poke fun at Menesilicus being disguised as a woman, with every moment that Euripides as Perseus comments upon saving this beautiful maiden from the monster, the archer makes a point to note that, no, this is a man. Ultimately just ends up devolving into more dick jokes and obnoxious bathroom-style humor that I simply do not care to continue to regale you with. Euripides as Perseus briefly suggests he's going to untie and free Menesilicus as Andromeda, but he's threatened by the Scythian archer, and so he leaves again, and then the archer just goes to sleep. Thrilling stuff, Aristophanes. The chorus returns to sing of the gods and of Athena specifically. They pepper in more political and historical references, notes about tyranny and things like that. I will refer you to the episode with Julie Levy and my upcoming conversation episode for more on that. Fortunately, I have others to share the historical context. Once their song is finished, Euripides, once again, returns to the stage. He finally reveals himself to be Euripides, the man this has all been revolving around, who they'd gathered to pass judgment upon. And he proposes a deal to the women of the festival. If they free Menesilicus, who he explains is his father-in-law, then he will never again insult their gender in his plays. He tells them that if they free him, they're in the clear. But if they don't free Menesilicus, oh, then he'll continue to reveal all their dirty secrets to the world. You know, because women are awful and secretive cheaters and liars and criminals whose secrets can be revealed for all to see. The women agree to this deal. They're so damned worried about those secrets. Happy International Women's Month. Nerds, I am so sorry. I am sorry because I think a lot of people like this play, and I definitely didn't do that justice. I didn't do any of it justice. Gods, I've never hated anything from the ancient world so much. And it was just so difficult to try to turn that into a narrative. That was the main problem. I think that if you're reading it and or watching it, you're really going to get something out of it and find it entertaining. Thankfully, my conversation episodes will remind everyone of that. Personally, I just want to yell at Aristophanes. I want to throw something at him, and I want to beg the gods to take this play back into the oblivion that is lost works from the ancient world and give us literally anything else by Euripides in its place. I know not everyone feels that way, so I am sorry. And again, that isn't really the full end of the play. There's this whole ridiculous scene where Euripides brings in some girl to sit on the Scythian's lap, and it gets weird and stupid, and people are chased around on stage like some kind of slapstick comic scene, and then finally it ends. But I didn't want to fuck with that, so here we are. Just read the play. If you care, I'm sorry. This is not my finest work. Frankly, I'm really angry at myself for picking International Women's Month, or even just thinking it was a good idea to cover this play at all. But not all my content can be perfect, I guess. Sometimes it's embarrassing, because, you know, when you're writing 6,000 words twice a week for going on 6 years, I can't all be winners. Such is life. I hope you enjoyed it, or at the very least that you learned something. At the absolute least, you are going to learn something from my conversation episodes, and thank the gods for that. On my end, I'm just grateful this is over. And just to really cap off how I've been feeling throughout this series, oh my god, the last 3 reviews I've gotten were 1-star. Angry dudes who don't like how I talk about the broader subject of the ancient world. So yeah, we're doing well over there, but I'm still going to finish with a 5-star review, because I found one amidst all those 1-stars. Maybe that'll nudge a few of you to leave me another 5-star to offset the angry men. I wouldn't blame you after this episode, though. Oh my god. This one is from a user called Jandy Michelle in the States. Thank God for this one. Phenomenal. Sensational. Literally my favorite podcast about my favorite subject. Liv brings the truth and information behind the stories to light with all the whimsy of your favorite myths. I'm constantly recommending this podcast to my friends, and each week I can't wait to hear more. Liv retells the stories from a modern perspective, and it's very refreshing and adds new life to old tellings. The podcast has all you could ever need and want in mythology, and I hope I never see the day where she stops, because each episode is an absolute delight. I could rave about it 24/7, but I'll simply end with 100 out of 10. We'll continue to recommend. I can't tell you how much I needed that after slogging through these episodes knowing that they're really bad and I don't have anything else that I can give you guys. So here we are. Thank you for that review. Honestly. Ugh. Let's talk about Myths VP is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Makila Smith is lucky she had nothing to do with this. We can't blame her for anything. This is all on me. I wouldn't blame her anyway. I'm just saying. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Next week, I will be back with some good women. Good women. No more Aristophany and misogyny. I am Liv. I normally love this shit, but it's been quite a couple of weeks and I now actively hate Aristophanes.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.